From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Juliet Lapidos, whose new novel is Talent, published by Little Brown. Juliet Lapidos is a senior editor at The Atlantic. Previously, she worked at the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, and Slate. She received her BA in Comparative Literature from Yale University and her Master of Philosophy in English Literature from Cambridge University, which she attended on a Gates scholarship. Here's a little information about Talent. Anna Brisker is a 29-year-old graduate student in English at Collegiate University who can't seem to finish her dissertation. Her project, an intellectual history of inspiration. And yet, for the first time, Anna has found herself utterly uninspired. Rather than work on her thesis, she spends her days eating Pop-Tarts and walking the gritty streets of New Harbor, Connecticut. As Anna's advisor is quick to remind her time is running out, she needs the perfect case study to anchor her thesis, and she needs it now. Amid this mounting pressure, Anna strikes up a tenuous friendship with the niece of the famous author Frederick Langley. Freddie wrote three successful books as a young man, then published exactly nothing for the rest of his wayward, hermetic life. Critics believe Freddie suffered from an acute case of writer's block, but his niece tells Anna that there's more to the story. When he died, he was at work on something new. With exclusive access to the notebooks of an author who was inspired, uninspired, and potentially re-inspired, Anna knows she's found the perfect case study. But as fascination with Freddie blooms into obsession, Anna is drawn irrevocably into the criminal machinations of his soul-living heir. A modern twist on the parable of the talents, Lapidos's debut is a many-layered labyrinth of possible truths that reveal at each turn the danger of interpreting another person's intentions, literary or otherwise. When I spoke with Juliet Lapidos, I began by mentioning how much I liked that she took the familiar theme of the lagging dissertation and turned it on its side to make it more interesting. I asked her if she had set out to write a serious book, which ended up being sardonically funny, or if she set out to write a humorous book, which ended up being quite meaningful. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
You know, that's a good question, and I think it's more the latter. I didn't set out to write a super serious book, and I do like a lot of comic fiction. I like and campus fiction, you know, David Lodge, and I love the book Lucky Jim. It's probably one of my favorite novels, and that's a very funny comic campus novel. But yeah, as I wrote, I found that I often fell into a kind of comic register. I think a kind of dry way, you know. I don't think the book is laugh out loud funny, but I found myself just falling into that without exactly meaning to. Often in the revision process, that I would write something and then in the process of going back to it and trying to punch up the language and just make the prose better, I'd find myself going in a kind of jokey direction.
Oh, but
that was
funny.
My solution to lagging prose, I guess.
That's interesting, because I always feel like I'm going to be much more spontaneous in my first draft. I don't think I could be funny in a revision, but that's great that you can. So let's talk a little bit about Anna Brisker. Her dissertation is on the origins of artistic inspiration, which clashes so nicely with her own lack of inspiration and her inability to finish. So beyond that, did you enjoy researching the origins of artistic inspiration? It looks like you undertook some research for that.
I did some. I had some familiarity with the topic. I mean, I should say that I went back and forth on exactly how detailed the description of her dissertation should be. And in fact, in the first draft, it was about something entirely different. It had to do with Henry Fielding, and it was closer to what I actually studied in my very brief experience, much briefer than hers, of graduate school.
Okay.
I decided that the dissertation topic had to be just closer to the themes of the actual book.
Right, yeah.
So I landed on this idea that it should be about inspiration itself. And so I did have some just prior knowledge about the history of the word inspiration and how the Romantics understood it, and some of the early 20th century psychoanalytic ideas about inspiration. And so I had a few building blocks, I guess, and then I read a few scholarly articles about different periods and different concepts at the time of how people ended up being able to create art.
Yeah.
But I guess I should say, you know, caveat lector, that I wouldn't recommend that anyone take my description of that history of inspiration and then, you know, turn it in the classroom or something. I don't think it would pass muster. It's very skeletal. And I mean, I think that one of the ways I do sort of acknowledge that in the book, that her advisor is kind of going, well, this isn't really enough for a dissertation, this theory you have about how inspiration works.
Yeah. Okay. Were you tempted at all to put in more detail about that stuff, or was it not a problem to kind of cull through and figure out what was just the right amount to put in here as far as the research of her dissertation?
I think in general, I often put in more. In earlier drafts, there was a lot more academic stuff and a lot more, many more paragraphs about, you know, her interpretation of different books and her research. And basically every time I went through the book, I took out more and more of it because I just thought it was bogging things down, mm-hmm. and that it was kind of getting in the way of the narrative in a book where there are already a lot of things that get in the way of the narrative. You know, there are footnotes and there are notebooks. And I thought that if the main narrative also had a lot of diversions into academic theory, it just wasn't going to work. So I pared that down.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to get to questions about that, but I actually loved the notebooks and the footnotes were great. But let's see. So before we get too much further, I just want to kind of cover a tiny bit of the plot. So Anna meets Helen. She meets her by chance in a store and offers to pay her $50, I think, tab when Helen, you know, isn't able to swing it. So then she spots her on the street and follows her to call in the loan. And then they become sort of, I don't know if you'd say friends. They become friends. They start to become friends. So, and then Anna sees this opportunity for Helen helping her with her dissertation. I really enjoyed the serendipity of their meeting. And I think readers love chance encounters. Actually, I think we do in life too. And I just wondered if you can talk about coming up with Helen and that situation that would lead into this larger situation.
Right. That's something I went back over, you know, a lot, figuring out exactly how to make them meet. And actually, the book originally started with the two of them meeting on a train ride, and then that wasn't quite working. It was taking too long. I really labored over figuring out when to give what information. So Helen turns out to be the niece of this famous author, and that's right. What truly connects these two characters. Anna's writing a dissertation, and she realizes that this this famous author can be sort of a case study for her to ground her dissertation that so far she hasn't been able to complete. And so that's what really ties her to Helen. And so I went, you know, the different drafts had that information coming out at different times, much earlier than in the final version and much later as well. I needed to have a way for them to meet and then have there be a reason for them to reconnect without giving away too much of the plot right away. So what I ended up doing was that in their first real conversation, Helen reveals that she is the niece of this author, but it's not until later that she reveals that this author had left behind some notebooks that are in this kind of legal limbo. But yes, I mean, it is a serendipitous meeting. They just meet at the supermarket, and then Anna spots Helen later on the street. So I do think it's one of those moments that if you look to that a certain kind of reader will be bothered by it. They'll look closely at it and they'll kind of go, there's too much coincidence in this for me. But for me as a reader, you know, I don't mind that in fiction. I just think, well, people have to meet somehow, so that's the way they meet, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know. There was a lot about the way that interaction developed, or the first internet action happened, and then their relationship developed, that I thought was perfect for the book, which actually I have a couple other questions before I get to why I think that. speaking of putting things in order, but anyway, I will get back to that. But so Freddie Langley is this author that you've created, who was a short story writer, very, very successful. And as we come to learn, it came easily to him, writing short stories that were very popular and well-liked. So I wondered if he was based on anyone, and you don't have to name anyone, but I was curious if there was someone you had in mind, or if there was like an amalgam of writers that you had in mind, or if you just made him up.
He's mostly made up, but I think people who've read the book so far, a lot of them think of J.D. Salinger, and I mean, I did too. You know, so J.D. Salinger is somebody who was very prolific and successful as a young person, and then made a conscious decision to stop publishing. And in Freddie's case, it's not clear why he stops publishing, but one possibility is that, like Salinger, he developed some kind of aversion to fame or to putting his work into the world. So I did think a little bit about Salinger, although Langley's or Freddie's or whatever name I should use for him, I don't know, he writes trifles in a way that Salinger didn't. So his actual style is quite different than Salinger's was, but I suppose there's something about their career arc that's kind of similar, and roughly the time in which they wrote as well. So Salinger is somebody that I did think about.
Okay. All right, great. Now, when you say he wrote trifles, there is this moment in the book where Anna is reading an introduction, I think, to Freddie's last book, and his editor had written that the highbrow crowd ignores talent that is popular, which I really liked that. And then Anna considers, after reading this, she says, critical feeding frenzies have little to do with the objective quality of the work in question. If a story could be used to promote a pet construct, nothing else mattered. I liked those. Let me just say that. I liked those two quotes. Do you agree with Langley's editor that the highbrow crowd ignores talent that is popular, or is that something that you feel strongly about?
I mean, yes. I think that there is a lot to that. I actually think that is changing. But that, yes, historically, I think that critics and scholarly critics have kept really popular stuff at arm's reach, and that popular things have to kind of be like laundered by history or something in order for academics to care about it. I mean, Dickens, right, obviously was immensely popular. Richardson was immensely popular, and they're, of course, you know, perfectly kosher for academic study. But, you know, it wasn't so long ago that Jennifer Weiner, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name,
yeah,
you know, was kicking up a storm on social media because, you know, she'd write books that were more popular than Jonathan Franzen's books, but the New York Times Book Review would ignore her. They wouldn't review her books.
Right.
Or when they did, it was just kind of a squib and they wouldn't pay much attention to her. Maybe they'd write about her in other sections, but not in the book section. When I was in college, the Shakespeare scholar, Stephen Greenblatt, came to give a talk, and he told this story about how he, you know, after, you know, many years of just kind of strict academic criticism, he wrote a more popular book called Will in the World about Shakespeare. And this sold very well. I think it was a New York Times bestseller. If it wasn't, then anyway, you know, it was a kind of a crossover hit. And other academics would criticize the book explicitly on those grounds, according to him, that they would kind of mock the fact that it had such a high sales rating on Amazon. And he kind of found this kind of funny. It's like, I'm the same person I was when I was doing the academic stuff, and because this book is popular, people think it's not serious, and they mock it on those grounds. So I do think that, you know, that's true. A lot of that happens, that if somebody is very popular, then people who are consider themselves serious about literature almost think, well, there must be something wrong with it if a lot of people like it.
Right, right, yeah. I think the other example that comes to mind, and this is maybe more of an exaggerated example, but I remember when Stephen King won a National Book Award for like contribution to literature or something, and there was actually quite a lot of backlash about that, I remember. So it's very interesting to me that in the very next scene, Anna, is it Anna or Anna?
You know, I said Anna in my head, but I suppose it's your right to call her Anna.
Okay, I'm going to say Anna, though. All right, so Anna chooses to ignore a possible red flag. She calls it a red flag when Helen admits to taking advantage of opportunities when they come along because she has bills to pay. I thought that was just wonderful. You know, she's just said that critical feeding frenzies have little to do, you know, if a story could be used to promote a pet construct, nothing else mattered. And in a way, she's sort of letting herself ride this and hope that it's going to be fine, even though she sees a red flag in Helen. Does that seem at all connected to you?
Thank you for noticing, for picking up on that. Yes, I mean, I think there are a lot of attempted parallels in the book, some of which are perhaps less... I think, you know, in some ways I hit the reader over the head with certain parallels, like Anna is researching inspiration, but she can't finish her dissertation. but then there are other things, yes, that, she's hyper-aware of flaws in the academic approach, but she doesn't really see them in herself. Yeah. And even the criticism that she has of how people understand inspiration, which is that, you know, this is so silly, there's no such thing as a lightning bolt moment, creating artistic work isn't really different than any other kind of work, you just have to do it. But when it comes to her writing a dissertation, somehow she can't do it. So perhaps she's wrong that all it takes is discipline, or maybe not, because she doesn't actually have a lot of discipline. But right, she, in the way that... you know, a certain kind of academic will just go, well, the only thing that matters is that I can advance my theory and advance my career, so I can ignore the flaws in this work of art, and that she treats people in that way, she being Anna, that Anna sees that there's something a little bit amiss with Helen, but thinks, well, I kind of need this person, so what?
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other parallel that I thought was lovely, which is something I mentioned earlier and said I would get back to, is I love that Helen's first interaction with Anna was to take advantage of that opportunity as well in the store when she needs money, you know, so that was all very consistent with her character and the way her character even sees herself. So I liked how you were able to kind of just put these themes into the actual action of the book and the characters and their development. So I liked that. I didn't feel hit over the head by most of the things. So.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Do you mind if I read a short little paragraph and then we can talk about it?
Sure. Go ahead.
This is actually a paragraph from the notebook. Jordan is an editor at a fancy Manhattan magazine. His job is to place words next to ads, but he believes he's an artist who works with artists, an artist who works at making artists better at their art, a wordsmith, a carver of language, a butcher of useless adverbs. His young assistant, Alan, is less pretentious. He gets that he works in advertising, and he has a knack for pleasing the money men. No, he won't assign a critical piece on a horrifically unsafe car when GM is paying for placement. Yes, he will send an ambitious imbecile to the fancy new West African hotel owned and operated by a brutal dictator. The publisher loves Alan. Slowly, Alan usurps Jordan's place. Jordan believes that this is the triumph of venal, shallow capitalism over solemn art and rigorous craft. Is it? So that's from Frederick Langley. That's from his notebook. That's his voice speaking basically through these notebooks that he kept. I'm going to have to bleep my own. but anyway, so I wanted to talk to you about establishing Freddie's voice through the notebooks and whether that was a challenge.
I did approach it very differently from the rest of the book because it had to be much looser, right? It's this notebook that probably he never intended for anybody to read, or perhaps he didn't intend for anybody to read, at least when he was first writing it. And it's a notebook, right? It's his little scraps of conversations, ideas for stories that he doesn't develop, or some ideas for stories that he develops just a little bit, but never to completion. So obviously that's quite different from writing the main narrative, in which things have to be kind of a lot more polished. They had to read differently.
Right.
And so my approach to that was to write a lot faster, that instead of, I sort of didn't allow myself to spend a lot of time on the first draft of the notebook entries. I kind of forced myself to write them very quickly.
Okay.
To get a lot down at once. And then I went back over it many times like I did everything else, and sometimes to make it even more casual than somehow it had come out in the first place. But I also tried to do certain things like he writes longer sentences than Anna uses because he's kind of riffing, and he also sometimes writes fragments, you know, that are more extreme fragments than Anna would use, again because he's writing a notebook, and he's a little punnier, like his sense of humor is different than hers. Like she is very kind of sharp and dry, and he is a little more I don't know, bouncy or something. I'm not quite sure how to describe him, but the things that he finds funny are different from the things that she finds funny.
Yeah, and he's, you know, he's from a different time, so his
right,
humor
yeah.
would be affected by that as well. And I thought, that, I mean, he's from the 60s. He's writing these notebooks presumably in the 60s, and that made sense to me, that would be a different kind of humor just because of the difference in time, too.
Mm. Right. The notebooks are actually from later in his life, so they're supposed to be from, like, the late 70s before he died.
Okay.
But yes,
oh.
it's still a different time. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Freddie is jaded by the publishing world, and Anna is jaded by academia. And you've had experiences of both, so I wondered if you find yourself weary of these worlds as well.
Well, there's... I think Anna's a lot more... they're both a lot more jaded than I am, but they both also have a lot more experience than I do. So, I mean, I went to college and studied English there, and I did a year-long master's program, but it's very different from the truly long slog of doing
right.
a PhD at an American university. So I think some of what Anna experienced is what I imagine maybe I would have experienced had I gone in that direction, but I did not. And Freddie is more, you know, thinking about other authors' experiences of the publishing industry, less my own. So again, just sort of imagining how other people might experience that. But they do. Every character in some ways reflects thoughts that I have had or
sure.
can imagine having. But I suppose more exaggerated. So I do think Anna is a more her take on academia is more exaggerated than mine would be.
Yeah. You titled all the chapters. Why did you choose to? I enjoyed them, and they made me curious to know what the chapter was going to be about. But I was curious how you came to do that.
I have to credit my husband for that. My husband is a book editor who's mostly worked on nonfiction, and he loves giving chapters titles as a way to help shape the structure of a book. And I thought that was fun, so
yeah.
I decided to do it for my book. I thought there was something, I don't know, that it's maybe more fun for readers than simply titling chapters 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
And that they, hopefully they help direct the reader in some ways about what the heart of a chapter can be.
Yeah, and I also think that the tenor of this book makes the chapter titles just contribute to the overall sense of humor of the book, and the sense that, you know, there's sort of a watchful narrator who's very tuned into the world. I don't know if that makes any sense, but...
It does. Yes, I hoped a little bit of that would come across. I mean, there's some... I think there are a few places where I kind of insert myself as an author, and part of that, yes, is the chapter titles.
Yeah, yeah. You're very hard on law school. is that just Anna and Freddie, or is that you too?
No, it's not really me. I mean, I know tons of lawyers, and I think law school is pretty great, but it does, I know a lot of people who did do the grad school thing, and the job market is very hard, and so I think there is this constant thought that, like, well, maybe I should go to law school, but that would be such a change in direction. And so I do think it kind of hangs over people's heads when they become academics, this other possible path that
right.
in some ways requires the same skills and being able to interpret words and then advance arguments about it. You know, I don't think that it's surprising that a lot of people who start out in English or history end up in law school for something beyond just practical reasons. But so, yeah, that's more Anna's aversion than mine, I think.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and I said Freddie, but I'm actually not sure if he actually did say anything about law school. I think it was in a footnote, so it's both Anna's things. But
yeah.
Now, the book just gave me so much to think about, and I wondered if, as you wrote, you know, these ideas were building on themselves without your having necessarily planned them. So, like, for example, the theme of alternatives to ambition, you know, just it's funny, there are certain things that we just accept as what should be, and I liked that reading this book made me kind of question those givens and think, okay, so ambition is supposed to be good, but what are the alternatives to ambition, and should we not be allowed to think about that a little bit? Did you find that as you worked, you were discovering new themes?
Yes. Well, that one I do think was kind of core to what
yeah.
I was trying to accomplish. So the title is in some ways a reference to the parable of the talents, which
right.
is... should I just give a quick précis of what...
Yeah, sure, yeah.
So it's kind of a lesser-known parable. I mean, it's not, you know, not as famous as the prodigal son or something, although I think people who are familiar with the New Testament know this story. But the idea is that there's a master who most people think stands in for God in some way, and he's going on a trip. And so he entrusts his three servants with his... with talents. Talent is a unit of money. So he gives one servant, I think it's 10 talents, although I'm not sure. He gives one servant 10 talents, the next one 5, and the third one just 1. He goes away. So the first servant who was given the most talents invests the money, and he makes a lot. The second servant does the same, although not quite as much. And the third servant is wary. He's worried about the possibility of losing what he was given. So instead of investing the talent, he buries it in the ground. Then the master comes home and he asks for an account of what happened to the money he gave his servants. And he's very pleased with the first servant and with the second. And the third, he's just enraged that the servant would basically squander what he'd been given by hiding it. I think the master might even refer to himself as like a taskmaster. Or no, the third servant says, I knew you were a taskmaster, so I was worried about the possibility of losing the money. But the master isn't having any of it, so he actually takes away the one talent he'd given him and gives it to the most successful servant. So this is kind of a dark parable, in
right.
my opinion.
God as capitalist.
Yes, exactly. It's very capitalist, right? It's like you have to, you know... you have to make money off of the money you're given. You have to produce something with what you have. And you know, a lot of people, because of the double entendre talent, it becomes irresistible to think of it as a question of what you do with your natural abilities. But it's both. It's about what you do with your money and what you do with your abilities. And after I read that in college, it was just in my mind, you know, for years, I would sort of turn it over about... how this meshed with other ideas in Christianity and how it meshed with our culture. And I thought it would be interesting to try to write from the third servant subject position of the person who kind of reasonably thinks, I don't want to lose what I have, so I'm not
right.
going to invest it.
Right.
And then is punished for it. And so I do think that the many characters in the book kind of think through this problem. Like, what if you don't want to try to do something with what you have? What if you just want to sit on it? What's so wrong with that? I'm also interested in other books that have maybe indirectly dealt with these questions, too. That one of the books I thought a lot about when I was writing and that I mention in the novel is Oblomov, which is this 19th century Russian novel about a character who is extremely lazy. He just, mm-hmm. he in the first 50 pages, all he does is move from his bed to his chair. And he's a very frustrating character, but I do think it's an interesting type for our times when there's so much activity and so much required of us, and that I think a lot of people think it's actually moral, right, to always be doing something, and that there's something wrong with inactivity and with passivity. And, you know, why is that? Why does everybody have to do something all the time? Right. So that's something that was certainly on my mind as I was writing. And, you know, other themes emerged from that, but that was always kind of central.
Okay, great. That was a really good summary of what a lot of this leads into. I thought that was great. Now, Anna's been sort of set up to some extent by all the expectations people had of her when she was younger. She was a very bright student, and just seemed like she had so much potential. And I've read online some of your early readers say that they appreciated the humor of the book, but there were aspects of the book that they found a little bit sad. And I always wonder, or I was wondering as I was reading, if this had to do with Anna. You know, she's got so much. So many people are looking to her to succeed, and she herself aspires to professor emeritus, but she doesn't particularly like teaching, I think, or I think she says she doesn't really like teaching, grading, or researching, or else that's just a sardonic thing she says at one point, but it was a little bit sad, and I wondered why you felt that she would be, you know, aspiring to professor emeritus if that's the case.
Right. So the idea there is that, I suppose this isn't actually a very unusual trait. I mean, she doesn't like to work. She likes having worked. She likes having the satisfaction of something being behind her and being able to point to it. But the actual experience of researching is drudgery to her. But I do think a lot of people have that experience in whatever it is they do, and I often feel that way about writing. It's not the process of writing that I find joyful. I just feel the need to do it for whatever reason, and then I like having done it. And she's just a more extreme version of that, I think. But I do think there's something a little bit sad about this person who, you know, she's lonely, she's a little socially awkward. I mean, the book is told from her perspective, so I don't know how much it comes across just how kind of odd she is when she is with other people. But she is a little odd. I hope that is clear that she's a little odd. But yeah, she's not a character that I would think any reader would kind of aspire to be like. she's lonely. She's fallen behind. She, in some ways, is very perceptive, but she's, in other ways, she's kind of blind to what's going on around her and to her own flaws. She's not actually very clear on what she wants. I can see why some people find the book kind of sad. As I said, the humor isn't really laugh-out-loud humor, so I don't think it's not really a comic novel. It's just often in a slightly comic register.
Yeah. Okay. I liked Pop-Tarts as a symbol of laziness, which is what I came to see them as in a way. It was like all the time the mentions of how she loves Pop-Tarts, and it's like, oh, that's a metaphor.
Exactly. Yeah.
Those were fun. Let's see. And Freddie found writing easy. So that's another interesting thread. You know, Freddie found writing easy, and he was able to kind of like just churn, if he wanted to, he could have churned out this material that would have made him a very nice living for a very long time. And instead, he walked away from it. And you know, up against her difficulties writing her dissertation, that just seems like another wonderful complication in the book.
Yes. Although I, you know, part of what I was trying to do is to say, well, it's not exactly clear why he stopped writing, and so there are some people, some characters within the book, who believe that the reason he stopped writing was because, like Anna, he was blocked, So there's a kind of an internal debate about it. There are some people who think he chose to stop writing, and there are other people who think no, he didn't have it anymore for whatever reason. So it's possible that he is more like Anna in that way, that she at one time was kind of an academic, you know, whiz kid, and until she wasn't, and he was a publishing whiz kid until he wasn't, and in even in Anna's case, I think it's not totally clear why, you know, why do any of us stop being able to produce work? It's probably for lots of reasons, or maybe the simple reason that we're actually not as good as we thought we were, and then we hit upon a project that, you know, just because you can write a short story doesn't mean you can write a novel. Just because you're good at, like, writing essays in a classroom context doesn't mean you can write a dissertation that can be turned into a book. Or maybe there's something more psychological going on. Who knows? But yeah, so there is, the, you know, they both have this trajectory of having been productive and then not being productive. Although, you know, with him, there's more of a possibility that this was a true choice.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to ask you, Juliet, if you've read any books lately that you might recommend to listeners.
Happily. One is a nonfiction book called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, which is about Haiti in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake. It's by Amy Wilentz, who I know from Los Angeles, and she's been traveling to Haiti since the 1980s, I think that's right, and seems to me that she probably knows more about the place than basically anyone else off the island. So she gives a really deep look at this situation of Haiti post-earthquake, but also at Haitian culture and history, and this is packaged with a very cutting criticism of, I think, what at one point she calls the foreign aid industrial complex and the problems with charitable giving. So it's a great book. I don't actually read a ton of nonfiction books, in part because as part of my job I have to read a lot of news, and so when I read I tend to read fiction. But this was really good, and written kind of like fiction, and she's also written fiction. And the other is completely different. It's a second century Latin novel called The Golden Ass, and I think it's the only surviving novel from that time, which I think is kind of funny, because I think most people think of the novel as having started maybe with Don Quixote or maybe with The Tale of Genji, but not in the classical era. But in fact, Roman citizens wrote novels too. So I read the Robert Graves translation, and it's very fun. It's the story of a young nobleman who's accidentally turned into a donkey by his lover, and then all his adventures in the form of a donkey. So that's very you know, fast-paced and funny.
Oh, great. Those are wonderfully different from each other. That's exciting. Okay. Thank you. And then are you working on another piece of fiction at this point?
Yes, slowly.
A sigh. Wow.
I haven't had much time for it, so it's kind of hanging over my head. I would very much like to write another book, but between finishing this one and the publication of this one, I had a child who's great, but no longer devote all my weekends to this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah.
All right, so Juliet, my last question always has to do with advice for writers, and I wanted to know if you, and you can divert from this and not specifically do what I'm asking, but I was curious if you have any advice for sort of developing characters and plot that maintain a real focus on the theme and the interconnected pieces like we've been talking about.
Hmm.
Or advice that comes to you for listeners who are writers that has nothing to do with that.
Maybe I should go with the latter, because I'm having, my problem was more the reverse, that I found myself being too argumentative, and then I had to kind of peel away some of the thematic stuff from the narrative.
Okay.
I mean, one thing I find helpful is that when I am stuck, then I start composing just like in a Gmail blank email instead of a Word document, because it seems to take the pressure off, because you're just it's as if you're composing an email, but you're writing instead. So I find that very useful, both in my job as a journalist and with fiction that it takes the pressure off to try to compose in Gmail instead of Word.
And then do you send it to yourself, or do you copy and paste it into something else?
I end up, I suppose, when I'm done or when I have something in place, then yeah, I copy and paste it into the whatever manuscript document I'm using. And then maybe I'll change it more, but that helps me get over the hurdle of the, you know, daunting white page thing. That if it's an email, it just doesn't feel daunting.
Oh, I like that. That's great. Okay, wonderful. I want to just mention again the name of the book is Talent, a novel by Juliet Lapidos and published by Little Brown. Juliet, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Juliet Lapidos, author of Talent, published by Little Brown. You can learn more by following Juliet on Twitter. She tweets at Juliet Lapidos. This week's Write the Book prompt is to take a familiar theme and try to turn it sideways so a reader might see something new. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV-LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.